it's mirza milk. It occurs three times in the Torah. What do we learn from this? We learn you can't mix milk and meat. Two sets of dishes, you know the whole works. What's it saying in the verse? It says, don't boil kid's mother's milk. And the oral Torah tells us that this implies no milk and no meat. But that's not what it says in the verse, right? Maybe the rabbis made it up. Right? It says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. What about boiling...
What is it? Chicken.
Chicken's a more complicated issue. Let's talk about boiling beef in lamb milk. How about boiling beef in lamb milk? A lamb is not the mother of a cow, right? You see how that is a generalization? There's a tremendous generalization which has taken place. Why do we make that generalization? Because the oral Torah tells us to make that generalization. Did the rabbis make that up? Did they? Maybe it was an indoor sport. They said, hey, let's see how many ways we can generalize it. Let's take another verse in the Torah. The Torah tells us you shouldn't wear shatness, and it tells us that shatness is a mixture of wool and linen. You're not allowed to wear a mixture of wool and linen in your garments. Can we think of some ways of generalizing that law of not wearing wool and linen? How about not wearing any animal fiber with any vegetable fiber? So you couldn't wear cotton with wool. Would that be a generalization of it? Right? But we don't do that. The oral Torah doesn't do that. In the case of boiling a kid in its mother's milk, it generalizes tremendously to all sorts of areas. In the case of shatness, wool and linen, it does not extend that or generalize it in any way to anything except wool and linen. Why all this generalization in one case and the other if people are just making it up? Why don't they make it up in both cases? Let me tell you one of the arguments that people have about the oral Torah. They'll say the following, and listen carefully. They'll say, how can you really believe that this oral Torah comes from Sinai? Look at the rabbis. They're always arguing with each other about it, right? And they're always arguing about these hair-splitting details. You know about that, right? So how can you trust this whole process? Listen to those two criticisms. How can you believe this whole thing? They're always arguing. No one agrees with anyone. And there was arguing about all these little hair-splitting details. I think you'll find the two objections answer each other. It's like the story of a woman comes back from the Catskills and her son says, how was it in the hotel? She says, it was terrible. What was the matter? The food was awful. You couldn't eat it. It was like poison. And they gave you such small portions. Both ways, Mom, right? You can't have both arguments. So what do they say? Number one, the rabbis are always arguing. How can you trust them? Number two, they always argue about the hair-splitting details. Listen to those two together. They never argue about the big stuff. Right? So here's the way it goes. We have the idea the rabbis made this up, right? They made it up. We have a law in the Talmud about marriage, kedusha. That kedusha takes place, the man gives something of value to the woman. How much value, we use a ring, how much value does it have to have? There's an argument between Hillel and Shammai. Hillel says a pruta, Shammai says a dinar. A pruta is about a penny, a dinar is about $2. All right. So Hillel says it has to have value of a penny, Shammai says it has to value about $2. Now, I think you can see this is a theoretical argument, because no one, if, let's face it, any guy gives his wife a ring worth $2, he's going to throw it back in his face, right? So, you can realize this is not a case that happens real often in our history, all right? And yet, we have the argument. Hillel says a penny, Shammai says $2, right? So let's imagine the rabbis are getting together, making up the oral Torah. One of them says, I think we should have an idea that there's life after death. Another one said, because it doesn't say that in the Torah, in the written Torah, right? That's only oral Torah. I think we should have an idea of life after that. They say, good idea. Who are we to argue with you? And they all agree, right? Next one says, well, I think that we should have an idea that there's heaven and hell. Hey, that's a good idea. It doesn't say that in the written Torah. Let's make that up. And they all agree. Someone else says, Shabbos. You shouldn't do malacha on Shabbos. I think we should make up that there are 39 categories, not 38 and not 40, but there are 39 categories of work. Of Malacha, you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. They all say, hey, great, 39, good round number. We'll all pick that, all right? Now we get on to brass tacks. A man should marry a woman by giving her something of value. Good idea, everyone agree, we all agree with that. How much should it be worth? A penny. Oh no, $2. No, a penny, $2. And for 2,000 years, we hear this argument. Does that make sense? You see, the Torah, the oral Torah, the Talmud, preserves every argument. Preserves every argument. All the Talmud really is arguments. The big stuff that everyone agrees in is not written in the Talmud. Only the arguments are. Because we are fiercely preservative of truth. The Jews are a fractious people. Look at political parties. U.S. has two political parties. Canada has three. Italy, it's a fractious country. Italy, eight political parties, right? Then we get to the Middle East, Israel. Right? 29 political parties. 16 in the Knesset. Three communist parties, right? They can't even agree on what Marx says. And we don't find this. We don't find this. We don't find this strange in the least, because we know how Jews are. Right? So Hillel and Shammai, they can't get together. Couldn't they split the difference at a buck? Let's compromise. Oh no, we're not going to compromise. Not on the serious issue of whether it's a penny or $2. That we can't compromise on. Heaven and hell? 39 calories of work on Shabbos, etc., etc. Oh, that will compromise. Make it up, we'll go along with you. But not on this issue. Doesn't make sense, does it? Yes, the rabbis always seem to be arguing, but only about the details. The big stuff they don't argue about. Whenever an argument occurs, we record it to make sure it doesn't get lost. Is it a tragedy? Yes. Because we've lost a part of Torah. The parts of Torah have been lost. We don't know whether it's a penny or $2. But we go according to Hillel for various reasons, but we're not sure. And that's a tragedy. We don't sweep it under the carpet and pretend that the difference doesn't exist. And you're going to tell me that in this environment, the oral Torah was made up. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit with the reality and history of what's going on. There is an argument in the Talmud about how to make tefillin. Actually, it's not in the Talmud. There are commentators in the Talmud. One is called Rashi. And Rashi had who founded a school of thought called the Tosfos. And there's an argument between Rashi and Tosfos, which is from the Middle Ages, as to the order in which the verse in the head tefillin, which men have, there are four scrolls. And they disagree as to what order those four scrolls should be put in. So you see what a small difference that is? Everyone agrees tefillin should be black, they should be square, they should be made from leather. Where's it come from? It says you should bind these words on your arm. That's what it says in the Torah. You should bind the words on your arm. Do you think you might be able to tie them on with string? Would that fit the verse? Does anyone say you can tie them on with string? No one says that. They all say tefillin, black, square, made from leather. Detail laws everyone agrees with. Where do they disagree? Rashi and Tosfos, 1,000 years ago, disagree as to the order in which the four scrolls should be put into the head. You see how small the difference is? But we might ask, what did they do before Rashi and Tosfos? 1,000 years ago, how'd they make tefillin, right?
Actually, it was Rabbeinu Tam.
Rabbeinu Tam is one of the Tosfos. The difference between Rashi and one of the Tosfos. Well, they excavated Masada. You know what Masada is? Masada is like 1,000 years before Rashi and the Tosfos. And they found tefillin. Hey, now we can answer the question. Who was right? Yeah? Guess what they found?
Both kinds.
You see, Rashi and Tosfos, writing 1,000 years ago and taking their opinion, were in an environment in which this argument was already at least 1,000 years old already. You see how they're not making this up? You see that? You see how accurately everything has been transmitted for thousands of years? Do errors occur? Of course errors occur. But they're very small. That's what we mean by a transmission process. I'll finish this talk with one story. And then we'll get on to the next one. Right? Right way? Well, very quick break. A few months ago, I got a call from my son. He's not here now, I can tell you. My son Pinchas' Talmud teacher in the yeshiva he goes to, Talmudic Academy. He calls me up and says, I want to talk to you. The teacher wants to talk to me about Pinchas. All right, what is it? He says, I want you to know. I'll say this exactly what he said to me, then I'll explain to you what it means. He says, I want you to know you shlugged me up today. Now, shlug up means to bust up, to destroy. In class today, he destroyed me. I was giving an explanation of the Talmud, and he contradicted me in class and proved that I was wrong. He says, I knew that you would want to know that. I said, oh, thank you for calling. And he was overjoyed. He was overjoyed. He says, I knew that you would love to hear this. All right? I said, thank you. And what was his attitude? His attitude was, we did good this year with him. He blessed it. He shlugged me up. Can you imagine a college professor? All right. As a girl I know was in a class, and they were studying Flaubert in English, in a literature class. And the teacher is reading, I think it was Madame Bovary. Yeah, maybe the wrong novel by Flaubert. And there's a sign in which a dog leaves the room. And she says, you know, this dog symbolizes God leaving the scene. Because dog is God spelled backwards. That's the symbolism. And my friend raised her hand. She says, just a minute, Flaubert wrote in French. This is an English translation. Right? God in French is chien. And a dog is chien. And God is dia. And they have no relationship. And the teacher got real angry. So, well, Flaubert, New English. And that was the end of that. All right? You can't imagine a college student going back to his colleagues and saying, you know what? One of my students showed I was wrong in class today. Isn't that great? You can't imagine a college student, my little son, gets a nickel if he can ask a question the teacher can't answer. Right? That's not the college environment. But if you're trying to keep things accurate for 3,300 years, you have to train people who, I hate to say it, although lawyers won't mind this, attack. You have to be able to answer. This is what we mean by a transmission process that assures that we have an accurate picture of Victoria in 3,300 years. After 5 minute break, we'll get under control.
Please, would you make a cup of coffee or something, or does it data show that there is...
Is there a track record that shows us that this indeed is the controlling force of our history? Yesterday there was a lecture on the seven wonders of Jewish history. And I just want to review what the principal concepts behind that talk were. That is that the prophets predicted seven themes in Jewish history. And these themes are the types of themes that are so outside the ordinary behavior of the world that it's unlikely that a person could have predicted such things. Remember the examples. That the nation would become small and scattered, yet it would survive. This doesn't happen. So these are examples of what we mean by control. Evidence that whoever it is that wrote this document, indeed, is controlling and calling the shots and predicting what happens. I want to talk right now about a different aspect of control. It's going to be what we call the psychology of control. Psychology. The mindset of whoever the author was who wrote this document. Now, you all have your textbooks with you, okay? We're going to use those in this talk. What is the mindset of whoever it is who wrote this document? Let's pretend that we are a group of Jews who, for whatever crazy reason, are making up this religion. We have a religion in front of us, right? We have a Torah in front of us. It must have come from somewhere. Let's assume that we're for a crazy reason, we're the committee writing the Bible. And we want to come up with some ideas. Give me an idea of what we should put in here. Give me an idea of some law we should put in this. What do you think?
You should believe it.
A law, something we should do. What should we put in it? Well, a law. What kind of law should we have? That's the law. I know. What laws?
Well, you are around.
Yeah.
You should treat other people well.
Treat other people well. Good idea.
Don't kill.
There's a good law. All right. See how we're coming up with our laws. How about telling people don't wear a mixture of wool and linen? It may not come to mind immediately, but not a bad law. Can we agree, Wander? Are we going to get in trouble if we put in such a law? Are we going to get in trouble if we do it? Well, we may not want to do it, but it's great. But it's not going to cause us any trouble if we do that, right? Okay, I'm the committee chairman. I'll give you another law. How about we put in the following rule? Every seventh year, you're not allowed to plant any crops. Is that a good law or bad law?
Good law.
Good law, bad. Why is it a good law? Why is it a good law?
It allows the land to rest.
Allows the land to rest and so on, crop rotation. Why is it a bad law?
Well, I mean,
you can eat.
Well, yeah, I guess one idea would be to maybe have sessions of rotating land. Let's say you divide your land into seven.
Ah! Listen, a good committee member. We have to have a unified committee here. What's your name?
Ben.
Ben had a good idea. It's a bad law because you don't have anything to eat, right? You're going to starve, right? However, Ben has a good idea. We'll divide the land into seven districts. And in each district, we'll have a different year in the seven-year cycle in which it rests. So we'll have food to eat from the other six districts. Good idea? Okay. How else could we implement this law without starving? How about if we tell people to store up things? That's a good idea, right? Store grain, all right? How about if we tell them to buy from their neighbors? Right? So I tell you no. I'm the chairman of this committee, and I have a better idea. Here's what my idea is. I will tell them not to buy the food from the other neighbors, and we'll tell them not to store the grain, and we'll tell them not to take Ben's cockamamie idea of seven districts. All right? We'll tell them in the whole land of Israel, don't plant every seventh year. But here's what we'll do. The year before, the sixth year, we'll make sure they get a triple-size crop, so they'll have enough to eat for that year, the next year, and even the year after. How about that? Should we do that?
Why not? That's a good idea.
Because you just told them they couldn't store.
Yeah, no, we're not going to store anything. We promised them that the land will produce triple what it usually produces the year before. How if we do that?
I still say, so what?
What are you going to do with it?
Plant your crops the way you normally do, and the year before, this year when you're not going to plant, your land will produce three times as much as it normally does. You don't have to worry, you'll have enough food.
How can you guarantee it?
Yeah, how can I guarantee it?
So you can't store it.
No, I'm telling them not to store from the previous years. Not to store from the previous years. You don't have to worry about it, we'll tell them.
It'll grow by itself?
Automatically, it'll grow by itself. Just right before, by itself, the land will miraculously produce triple crop and you'll have enough to eat. Now, suppose we make up this law. How long is this religion going to last?
Till the seventh year.
Till the seventh year. Then what are they going to do to us? With the strength that they have left in their starvation, they're going to slaughter us, right? This is not going to be real successful. Why don't we find the Torah? Page 126, please. Look what it says. This is from the Torah. Item number 2 on page 126, where it's underlined, verse 3. For 6 years you may plant your fields, prune your vineyards, and harvest your crops. But the seventh year is a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the land. It is God's Sabbath during which you may not plant your fields nor prune your vineyards. Do not harvest the crops that grow on them, or on their own even. Even if they grow on their own, during this year you can't harvest them. It's a year of rest for the land. Now look to the bottom, verse 20. If you ask, what will we eat in the seventh year? We have not planted, nor have we harvested crops. What are we going to eat? I will direct my blessing to you in the sixth year, the year before it happens. And the land will produce enough crops for 3 years. Don't worry about it. Who wrote this?
Optimus.
You see, suppose we had said to them, you'll get a whole lot of food if you follow the Shemitah year. If you follow it, then you'll get, the next time around, in the intervening 6 years, you'll get a whole lot more crops. If it doesn't happen, we can say, uh-oh, someone cheated. Right? It doesn't happen if they're not getting us the crops. You can say, someone cheated. Someone doesn't say that. It's not conditional. This is not a conditional promise. It's a promise that in the sixth year, you will get a triple crop, independent of what you do, and this will enable you to keep the Shemitah. Who wrote the law? the law had to be written by someone. And this is what we mean by the psychology of control. Who wrote this? Would human beings have written such a thing? Let me give you another example. I have another law for you. Tell me if it's a good law or a bad law. We're the committee, remember? We're the committee making up the Bible, right? Here's the law. 3 times a year, all of the people, the entire population, all the adult males, all the males, must travel to Jerusalem 3 times a year. Everyone in the whole country has to come. Good law or bad law?
Bad.
Why bad?
Who's going to protect the borders?
Well, okay, there's a little bug in it there. Who's going to protect the borders? Why is it a good law?
Unity.
Brings unity. Everyone comes, we read the Torah, all right? We create unity. We check that everyone knows what's going on. Torah contests. Right? Serious. You know, people ask questions, make sure that the Torah is being transmitted accurately, even within the country. 3 times a year, everyone gets together to study. What's the problem? Who's going to protect the boy? You know, we know that traditionally Israel has always been surrounded by very friendly powers, right? So what should we do about this? We're the committee, right? We're going to write a Bible that's going to say in the text when we're going to leave the borders unprotected, right? If anyone picks up a copy of this, they'll know. They'll see it year after year. Now, when you can, so what will we do? So how about we have a law? We'll leave border guards. Or something like that. No, that's not what we're going to do. Look at item number 3. 3 times each year, all your males shall thus present themselves before God, the Master, the Lord of Israel. Okay. Have to go to Jerusalem 3 times a year. When I expel the other nation before you and your boundaries, no one will be envious of your land when you go to see God's presence 3 times each year. Leave your borders undefended. Nobody will envy your land to come in. You'll be perfectly safe. Who wrote this? Was it Jews or was it Assyrians? They sent in a committee and said, hey, let's tell all the Jews to leave the borders unprotected and see if we can get away with this. How stupid could they be? Who wrote the law? See what we mean by the psychology of control here. Yes?
Has anybody tested Shemitah recently to see if the crops grow 3 times?
Good question. Notice that in all of these cases it says when you are come into the land during the time period when the Jews as a nation are resident in Israel, these mitzvahs come into effect and these things happen. During the times of Golus, they do not. Times of exile. When the majority of Jews are living in Israel is when we will see this.
So then we can't actually verify.
We can't verify now. That we can look to Talmudic sources and biblical sources to tell us indeed it did happen. Because they did live that way. And we see that they did. All right, we're in a time now. We have to distinguish between times of residents and times of non-residents.
You mean before the diaspora that we refer to?
Yeah, that's right. Nowadays, we're not going to leave the borders undefended because we're not in one such time. When Mashiach comes, we don't have to worry. Yes?
No, I was just going to say, it becomes circular. I mean, that's a flaw in the sense that but your faith in this concept that there's going to be a Messiah is going to come and there's going to be world peace.
No, listen, again, this is written at a time in which everyone was living there, right? When this was written, by all scholars agree, this was written at a time when all the Jews almost lived in Israel. And it was referring to that time. Who wrote it? At the time this was written.
And
whether
the Torah
it was
eternal. You say the Torah is eternal, so to say that it's not, that's not
what you're saying. What I'm saying is biblical critics would say that this was written by human beings at a time in which all the Jews were in Israel. We say God gave it to us before we even came into Israel and said this will come into effect when you enter Israel. Right? Biblical critics say that during the time of Ezra the Jews were living in Israel when they wrote this. Who would write such a thing? Yes.
How can you make that statement, though? How can you say that it could 100% not be written by somebody? I understand your point of view. How can you really say that with absolute certainty?
I can never say anything with 100% certainty. I can never do that. I can ask questions. And I can ask Jews living in Israel would they have written such a thing? Making up the law, making up the Bible. There are so many simpler ways you can do it. For whatever crazy reason, you wanted to leave the land fallow every seventh year, you have a superstition, fine. Let's take Ben's solution. And it was Ben, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And break the land into districts or something like that. But why go to this crazy risk? Why leave the borders undefended? Why tell people to do that? What kind of crazy people would do such a thing? Could there have been crazy people? Maybe there were. Would Jews have listened to them? I doubt it, because they're Jews. You see, it's not 100%. Bits and pieces of evidence. But it doesn't make sense. Who wrote the law? They were living there. Who wrote these things? Yes?
Just looking at the way it's written in the English translation, when you come to the land that I am giving you, mm-hmm. What you said about when all the Jews were in Israel,
yes.
That is one way to read this, but of course in the English, there are a number of other ways you could read the same thing. So couldn't one say that your way of looking at it is a way to make it make sense? Because otherwise it would.
You have a good point. It says in Hebrew, "Ki savo el haaretz," which does mean when you are come into the land. Now we have to be careful. And here's a translation problem. In English, we have past, present, and future tenses. In modern Hebrew, you have past, present, and future tenses. But in classical Hebrew, you really don't have that tense structure. You have perfect and imperfect tense. Right? You really have a different way of thinking about time. This is in the imperfect. The imperfect, as I say, in modern Hebrew, is used as a future. But it really is an imperfect, meaning a continuous, uncompleted action. And therefore, ki savo el haaretz means when you are coming into the land, when you're in the process, when you're there, in a way. It's slightly different. But it is a little ambiguous. I'll agree with you that it is ambiguous. Okay? It is always understood through the oral Torah to refer to the time in which we are resident in Israel. There are many mitzvahs that really we are bound by only when we're in Israel. We are not as fully bound by Shemitah nowadays as we are when we're older than now. We're bound by it in some sense, but not as fully. There are many laws that are not in effect, Torah laws that are not in effect because we're not resident in Israel. And the temple is not built and people are not living there. And this is an example of one of them.
Isn't there some evidence, though, of there being bountiful crops? I mean, they do keep a certain amount of Shemitah, right?
Yeah, but remember...
But isn't there some evidence of there being...
We have seen that, yes. I mean, as a matter of fact, before the last Shemitah year, there was a huge bounty of crops that appeared in Israel.
Yeah.
That's true. It did happen.
Yeah.
But I'm not bringing that as part of the argument because it's not fair to bring it because this is not one such time.
Right.
God wants to give us an extra big crop for whatever reason that God gave it to us. Okay. We're not promised it. It happened. Fine. Okay. I mean, we did observe this, but
right.
The thing is that it's not something that we want to base a proof upon. We're going to be more tough-minded than that. Yes.
They actually have calendar dates for years that they're not supposed to grow crops.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
I was thinking.
How do you
know
this is
not affecting
the following thought? Kisavo el haaretz, and we understand that through Tarsha Bapet to refer to the time when the Jews are officially resident in Israel with the temple. That means with the temple in existence. Okay. But I want to move on. This is what we call the psychology of control. We are really behind in this seminar, and therefore I really want to take just one more example of control. Because otherwise, Rabbi Porter back there will control me by hitting me over the head. Remote control. He'll push the button and my microphone will go off. I want to give you one more example of what we mean by control, what we mean by track record. Concept of the Torah as a paradigm of history. Now, what we've had so far, in terms of control, have been prophecies, as we saw with regard to the seven wonders. Here we have the psychology of control, laws that had to be written by someone, and it doesn't make sense that humans would have written such a law. There's a whole third category of control, the Torah as the paradigm of history. We have a principle in Torah, Maisa Avos Simin Laboni, that the deeds of the patriarchs are a symbol or sign for the children. What does that mean? It means that what the patriarchs did was to set up a paradigm of Jewish history which we continue. continued to act out in our day. That when Abraham traveled all over Israel, he was staking claim for our generations. Interesting, the first Rashi in the whole Torah says that when a future time comes, the whole nations of the world claim that you are thieves who have stolen the land of Israel. You'll have a defense. God created the universe and gave it to us, and that's why the Torah begins with the story of Genesis. You know, people reading 100 years ago would read that Rashi and say, I can understand individuals might accuse us of being thieves, but the whole nations of the world to get together, they never got together, right? Nowadays, we have this wonderful seat of reason, wisdom, and justice called the UN. It says, you're thieves, you stole the land. It's coming true, little by little. You know that India just introduced a new prize? Do you know about this? It's called the Indira Gandhi Prize for the Promotion of International Justice and Harmony. Indira Gandhi Prize for the Promotion of International Justice and Harmony. And the first recipient was announced this year, Yasser Arafat. So much for India. Maisa Avo Simin Labani, the Patriarch's Action, a Paradigm of History. There is a Christian scholar who wrote that if God didn't write the Bible, it was written by an awful anti-Semite. Look who wrote this text. He wants the Jews to leave their land undefended three times a year. He wants them to starve every seventh year. What an anti-Semite. If God didn't write that, it was written by an anti-Semite. And who are the Jewish heroes that we see in this text? Right? Our father Abraham. Big hero, right? What does our father Abraham say when God promises him the land? He says, prove it. How do I know you're telling me the truth? That's our father Abraham. Indeed, he was the father of the Jewish people. You can see it. That's our reaction. Prove it to me. Isaac, our father Isaac, has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau is the bad one. Which one does he want to give the blessing to?
The bad one.
The bad one. Jacob, our father Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, fools his old father and steals the blessing. Right. Joseph and his brothers sell him into slavery. Leaders of the Jewish people sell him into slavery. That was on a good day. On a bad day, they wanted to kill him. Eventually, they say, Roman, these are the leaders of the Jewish people. Joseph himself languishes in prison. Why? Because he didn't believe enough in God. God says he didn't trust me enough. To Joseph, right. Who's the greatest prophet of the Jewish people?
Moses.
God says to him, you can't go into Israel. Why? You didn't believe in me enough. Moses, you troublemaker. He did something wrong. He didn't believe you. What's the most illustrious family in Jewish history? The family of David, King David, from whom the Messiah will come. What tribe did David come from? The tribe of Yehuda, right? Who was Yehuda's... Which son of Yehuda did David come from? From Peretz. How was Peretz conceived? Does anybody know? Remember Yehuda and Tamar? Yehuda doesn't want to do his duty to Tamar. Tamar plays the prostitute, pretends to be a prostitute, and gets Yehuda to sleep with her, and so on and so forth. And that's how Peretz was conceived. Do you think that this work was commissioned by the house of David? Don't you think if the house of David commissioned it, at least they would have given him a virgin birth? You see what I mean? This is not the way that people making up a story of their origin do it. They don't do it that way. Look in the ancient world when they would write about a king, when they would write about the sun god, he was born from the sun god, right? Or great victories, or so on. Again and again and again, the Torah seems to talk only about the bad stuff. Only about the bad stuff. It's brutally honest. It's disturbingly honest. Yes?
Well, couldn't you just please make the counter-argument that, that if you get people to believe in these crazy things, you really get them to do, you know, whatever you want to do. Anybody could believe it, but obvious, you know. We had something crazy.
It's hard to get Jews to believe in something, even if it's crazy. Finally, who is the biggest slime ball in history, from a Jewish viewpoint? Surprisingly, it's not George Bush. there's someone worse than George Bush, right? Amalek. Amalek, the historic enemy of the Jewish people. And from under what rock did this piece of slime crawl? Who is his great-grandfather? Do you know? His great-grandfather is Isaac, Yitzchak. Esav is his grandfather. He comes from Isaac. He's one of the sons of Isaac. This is the enemy of the Jewish people, the worst character of history. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Amalek. Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. One of them is a good guy, the other one is paskudnik, or however you say it in Russian. No goodnik. Right. And for three times, Jacob and Esau fought over the land of Israel. They fought about ownership of who's going to get the land of Israel three times. The first time was over a pot of lentil soup. All right. Progresso is not kosher. Kosher lentil soup. In comes Esau, and he's hungry. And he says to Jacob, I want some soup. And Jacob says, sell me your birthright. Sell me the right to the land of Israel for all generations. And Esau says, I think that's worth a bowl of soup. It's what we call an impulsive personality. We don't recommend this. The first time they fight over the land of Israel. What's the second time that they fight over the land of Israel? After Jacob returns from to essentially stake his claim, who is laying in wait for him to prevent him? Esau, with 400 men coming to kill him. Right? Second time that they fight over the land of Israel. Whenever Jacob wants to take possession of Israel, Esau's out there to stop him. What's the third time? The third time is not found in the written Torah. It's found in the oral Torah, in the Midrash. And it tells us the following. There was a third time. And it was after the death of Jacob. After the death of Jacob. Jacob was to be buried in the cave of Machpelah. Cave of the Patriarchs, thereby establishing that he is the representative of the Jewish people. And they go to take, they come back out of Egypt with the bones of Jacob to bury him in the cave of Machpelah. And who is waiting there? All of the brothers come, but Uncle Esau is standing there with a sword saying, you shall not enter, I will be buried there, my last chance to stake my claim. And a fight breaks out. Now, the oral Torah tells us that there was a son, Dan, one of the brothers, had a son named Hushin. And Hushin was deaf. He couldn't hear. What does he see? He sees this argument taking place. What's going on? They say, we have the claim to the land of Egypt, or to the claim of the land of Israel. We have the deed, essentially, and so on and so forth, to Machpelah. The deed from Ephron, Machpelah is on our hands. It's back in Egypt. He says, well, we'll send a runner back to get it. They're going to send a runner back. The argument's taking place. Hushin sees this going on. And he's very upset. He doesn't know what's going on because he can't hear. All he knows is Uncle Esau is there preventing Jacob from being buried. He gets so angry, he takes his sword and he cuts off Esau's head. Effectively ending the argument. Esau's head rolls into the cave of Machpelah. He got in there a little bit. And Jacob is buried. Three times in history, Jacob and Esau fight over the land of Israel. A paradigm of history. A paradigm of history. Out of Esau comes who? Amalek. And we learn from this that throughout history, whenever the descendants of Jacob try to enter the land of Israel, the descendants of Esau, namely Amalek, will stand in their way. Does it happen? Sure. What is the first occasion?
The
Exodus. We come out of Egypt. What happens on the way? We're attacked by Amalek. Why? What do we want from Amalek? Nothing. You see, all the other nations attack us with reason, for some benefit. Amalek hates us just because we exist. that Amalek attacks us. When are the Jews attacked by Amalek? When we're at our weakest. That's when Amalek attacks. We come out of Egypt, we're attacked by Amalek. The first confrontation. That was the first return to Israel, right? First time we go into Israel. We're in Israel a few hundred years, temple is destroyed, we're exiled to Babylonia, to Persia. Time comes for the second return to Israel. What happens? Second time we return to Israel. Haman.
I don't know how that has been interpreted.
In the Persian Empire, the Jews are going to go back to Israel. Haman decides to destroy the Jews. And Haman is a descendant of Amalek, as the Megillah tells us. Agagi, who comes from Amalek. So Amalek arises again in the guise of Haman to destroy the Jews when they're going to go back to Israel. He is foiled and they get back again. A second time. Third return to Israel occurs when? End of the 19th century, the beginnings of political Zionism. And we know that many of the Gedolim, many of the great scholars in Europe, were opposed to political Zionism. Do you know why? They say, if we try to go back to Israel, before we are ready, we will stir our Amalek again to destroy us. Leave well enough alone. Many of the Gedolim said that. Who is Amalek? Who is Amalek? There was a time in which, let me get the exact name here. Kaiser Wilhelm, in 1898, Kaiser Wilhelm visited Jerusalem. And Reb Chaim Soloveitchik at the time said that people should not go to greet him. Because he said he had a tradition from the Vilna Gaon, who lived 200 years earlier, that the Germans come from the seed of Amalek. And they shouldn't go.
I think it was about Sonnenfeld.
Or Chaim Sonnenfeld, was it?
Yeah.
Roll Reb Chaim. That it's, let me make a correction here. That it was from the seed of Amalek. What is the characteristic of Amalek? You know, different cultures in Judaism, they have their symbols, you know, eagle, whatever it is. And traditionally in Judaism, Amalek is symbolized by the pig. By the pig. And our Jewish tradition tells us an interesting thing about a pig. The pig is not kosher because it doesn't chew, it's cut. It does have cloven hooves. It's the only animal which is missing the internal sign. All the other animals that are missing some signs are also missing the cloven hooves, right? External signs. The pig is the only animal that has the external sign, doesn't have the internal sign. You know how a pig sits like this, with its legs out, and we say, look what it does. It says, hey, kosher. Inside, it's straight, but outside, it's nice and kosher. The characteristic of Amalek, Haman, the vizier, the second in command for the king, erudite, cultured, advanced person, that this is the nature of Amalek. On the surface, looks very advanced, cultured, and moral, but down and rotten to the core. What did we find in Germany? But the most advanced culture the world had ever seen, morally, ethically, everyone would say that. And yet, look what came out of it. Another characteristic of Amalek is what? Amalek hates the Jews for no reason at all. For no reason whatsoever. Just because they exist. Just because they exist. Do we have any evidence from the Oral Torah in terms of this identity? Please turn to page 47. We have here a quote from the Talmud. Tractate Megillah. Isn't it interesting where this occurs? It occurs in Tractate Megillah. Megillah deals with Purim, right? And yet we have this quote. Item number one. Rabbi Isaac said, what is meant by the verse? Grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. Draw not out his bit, so they shall exalt themselves. Selah. Interesting verse. What does it mean? Look at the leap that's made in interpreting this verse. From out of nowhere, the Oral Torah says the following. This refers to Germania of Edom. For should they go forth, they would destroy the world. Rav Chama ben Hanina said, there are 300 crowned heads of Germania of Edom and 365 chieftains in Rome. And every day one of them go forth to meet the other, and one of them is killed, and they have all the trouble of appointing a king again. Now, here's what the Talmud tells us. Who is it we have to worry about here? Grant not to Esau the wicked the desire of his heart. Who is this offspring of Esau who is so dangerous that they would go forth and destroy the world? Germania. If you look at ancient maps, the original name of Germania was not Germania with an N, it was with an M, Germania. At the time the Talmud was written, was there a nation in Germany?
No, there's a lot of duchies in
there. Nothing up there. Was there anything that would indicate this is a threat to the world in any way? Germany? It was Yenenveld. It was the Boondocks. And yet they say Germania of Edom. 300 kingdoms in Germania, 365 in where? In Edom. Edom is Rome, in Rome. 365 in Italy, and 300 in Germany, and there's chaos because they are divided. And that's what keeps them down. Don't mess with it. Don't mess with it. Leave them divided, leave them alone, don't draw out their bit. Because if they get you, if this situation of internal conflict between the countries and little city-states have unified. There are two exceptions. What are the two exceptions? Germany and Italy. They are still patchwork. Look what Shirer says in item number 4 on page 47. By the end of the Middle Ages, which had seen Britain and France emerge as unified nations, Germany remained a crazy patchwork of some 300 individual states. What did the Talmud say? 300 kings in Germania. What does Shirer say? 300 individual states. Completely different course. But what happens? 1871, Germany is unified by the Iron Prince Bismarck. At about the same time, Mazzini, Cavour, and Garibaldi unite Italy. What then happens? Within a generation, World War I. Where does it come from? It comes from Germany. Interestingly enough, Germany is unified, it leads into World War I. What position does Italy take in the war? World War I. Neutral. And Germany's doing okay. When does Germany run into trouble in the war? When Italy joins the Allies. That is the downfall of Germany. What did the Talmud say about the relationship of Italy and Germany? Keep them fighting against each other. Keep the conflict going so they don't destroy the world. Germany falls. And what do the Allies do? They dismember Germany. Somehow, intrinsically, they want to keep it apart. They want to keep it disunified. Hitler takes over. And what does he do first in his plan for world domination? What does he feel he needs to do to conquer the world? Two things that Hitler says he needs. And he writes about it in Mein Kampf. One is he has to reunite Germany. He has to take the Saar, the Sudetenland, the Rhineland, Danzig, Alsace, Lorraine. He has to reunify Germany. The second thing he must do that he writes about is what? Form an alliance with Italy. He says, I can take on Russia, England, France, the United States. I can take them all on as long as I have on my side Italy. And one of the, William Shirer writes that one of the unanswered questions of World War II is that Hitler, who broke every promise he made to everyone without compunction, there is one case where he never broke a promise, and that was to Mussolini. He risked everything to try to prop up Mussolini. When Mussolini fell from power, he went in to personally rescue him. Mussolini? I can take on the world, I gotta have Mussolini. Hitler is successful. Attempts of the Allies to invade are unsuccessful until what point in World War II? Until Anzio, they attack Italy. And then Germany begins to fall, when Germany fell off from Italy. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it happens. At the end of World War II, Germany is dismembered again. The Allies feel the way to prevent the world from being destroyed, dismember Germany. Okay, a couple of years ago, things changed. I'm worried about that. It's another matter. Maisa Abo Simon Labani. The deeds of the fathers are a symbol for generations to come. Three times the Jews attempt to return to Israel. Three times Amalek is stirred up to oppose us and attack us. But that's not enough for us. We want more evidence of control. We want something more direct than all of this. Quick question.
What you were saying about Amalek and the Germans, are you referring to all of them or just the, like, the top?
I'm talking here about what the comments. You're asking a good question. We do have a principle that we're not sure that the identity of all the nations is mixed up nowadays. It's not exactly pure. I don't want to get into that issue. We'll discuss that privately, but that's too much of an issue for me to discuss right now. I just want to talk about what we see here. My Sabbath and the paradigm of history. We just had a holiday called Purim. Purim talks about the events during the second return to Israel. Right? The second time that we went to Israel and Amalek stood against us in the guise of Haman. We attempted to go in. Haman wanted to kill all the Jews. Who can tell me what is unique about the book of Esther that makes it different from every other book in the Bible? Doesn't mention God. It's the only book of the Bible that doesn't have God in it. Well, is it written by a Reconstructionist rabbi? How come it doesn't have God in it? Isn't that kind of strange? Isn't that what the Bible's about? It's kind of about God, you know? In many ways, the book of Esther is the most modern book of the Bible. It may not be the last chronological, but anyway, the most modern. Because it talks about the hidden way in which God acts in the world. And the theme of the book of Esther is God's hidden action in the world. So God is not mentioned specifically. Even though everyone knows the book is about God's intervention, it's not mentioned specifically. However, there are hints to God's presence. In the book of Esther, sometimes it says in Hebrew, HaMelech Achashverosh, the King Achashverosh. At other times, it only says HaMelech, the King. And the oral Torah, the oral tradition tells us that whenever it says HaMelech, not HaMelech Achashverosh, not King Achashverosh, but it just says the King, it is really talking about God at that point, in some sense. So let's see what the book of Esther says. Please turn to page 51. Here you have the portion of the Torah, the portion of the book of Esther that deals with the climax of the story of Purim when the 10 sons of Haman were hung. And look what happens. In the center there is the English translation. Okay? Esther says the following to the king. She says, the Jews have slain, blah, 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 up at the top. And also, no, where is it she says this? We don't have the whole text here. At the very end, then Esther said, Esther's misspelled there, then Esther said, you see that? It's in the English, it's 5 lines up from the bottom. Then Esther said, she goes to King Achashverosh with a plea. She says, if it please the king Let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according to the day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hung upon the gallows. She says, if it please the king, let the Jews do tomorrow as they've done today and hang the 10 sons of Haman. If you look in the story of the Megillah, you see that they were already killed. They're already dead at this point. They're already killed. Queen Esther goes in and she says, let the 10 sons... She wants permission to hang 10 dead men. She risks, you know, if you follow the Purim story, going into the king was to risk your life, right? Because if you didn't agree to your presence, you would be killed. But she says, let the 10 sons of Haman be killed. Hung. They're already dead. The request is to the king, though. And when we see it saying the king, we know that in addition to what happened, it's also an oblique reference to God. And Esther is saying to God, let the Jews do tomorrow as they've done today. Let them do in the future what they've done today, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. That's her request. You see that? Let's skip a couple of 1,000 years to Nuremberg. Nuremberg. The Nuremberg trials. The Nazi war criminals are placed on trial. How many of them are sentenced to be executed? 11 are sentenced to be executed. When? During the summer of 1946. That's the death sentence, right? What is their petition? Does anyone know what their petition is to the court? Let us not be hung. Let us be shot. Why? Anybody know? No?
Well, it's military.
Military. In military, the honorable way of dying is to be shot. To be hung is
a criminal.
As a criminal. And as a matter of fact, if you follow the American Revolution, Major Andre was a spy, and he petitioned George Washington to allow him to be shot rather than hung. And Washington disagreed and required him to be hung. It was a prince of tremendous degradation that Washington was criticized for not allowing Major Andre to be shot. He had him hung instead. They petitioned to be shot. Instead, they are to be hung. 11 of them. But because of the petitions and the international outcry, the execution is put off from the summer of 1946 until October of 1946. Instead of being in the year 5745 on the Jewish calendar, it is delayed into the year 5746. And they are hung on Hoshana Rabbah, coincidentally. Hoshana Rabbah is the day of judgment for the nations of the earth on the Jewish calendar. That's when the 11 are sentenced to be hung. A few days before, Goering commits suicide. So how many are actually hung? 10. Let the 10 sons of Haman be hung on the gallows. Anybody know about an 11th child that Haman had? Because he had 11 children.
What is
it?
Daughter.
A daughter. What happened to her? She committed suicide. When she saw her father leading Mordecai around on the horse, she thought their roles were reversed, that it was Mordecai leading the horse, and she dumped a sewage pot on his head. She saw it was her father, she was so crestfallen, she jumped from the building and killed herself. 10 sons of Haman, 10 hung on the gallows, the daughter commits suicide. 11 Nazis sentenced to be executed. 10 of them hung, Goering commits suicide. And we know from a book on sexual deviation in the Third Reich that Goering was a transvestite underneath his uniform he wore women's underwear. Let the ten sons... It revolts the mind and imagination, I know, but that was the truth. One daughter commits suicide, Goering the transvestite commits suicide. The ten sons... If it please the king, let the Jews do tomorrow as they have done today, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. The 10 Nazis are hung. But this isn't enough for us, is it? It's not enough. Do we have a marker? A marker? When were they hung? What year did the hanging occur? Originally, they were scheduled to be hung in the year 5745. When did the hanging actually occur? It was delayed, remember? To 5746. How do you write 5746 in Hebrew? You write it, Tav, Shin, Zion. Tav Shin Zion. That's the way you write it in Hebrew. You know that in Hebrew, letters and numbers are interchangeable. So 57, year 5746 is Tav Shin Zion. But let's see what this really means. Tav has a numerical value of 400 in Hebrew. Right? Shin has the value 300. And Zion is 7. Did I say 57, 45? I was confusing 1946. I'm sorry. I said the wrong year. It was 1946. It wasn't 5746. It was 1946. 1946 began as the year 5706 on the Jewish calendar. And then after, when they were hung, was the year 5707. I said it incorrectly. This is a 7. When you add these up, you get 707. So the way that you write the year 5707 on the Hebrew calendar is as 707. You don't write the thousands place. Because there's no way of writing that in Hebrew. We always just write the rest of the year. But how many times has the year 5707 come about since the beginning of the calendar? What number occurrence is that? The first occurrence of that year, of the year Tav Shin Zion, was the year 707, right? The next occurrence was the year 1707. 2707, 3707, 4707, 5707. It is the sixth occurrence of the year 707 on the Jewish calendar, right? The number for six in Hebrew is a vav. A vav. Okay? This is the year in which the Nazis are home. Turn back again to page 51. You have there a page from the Megillah, exactly as it's written. Notice something strange about it? It's indicated to you through the use of little circles. The names of the 10 sons of Haman are all written extra large, and every Megillah is written in this way. But there are three letters that are written extra small in that text. And we've never been told why. Esther didn't tell why. When Esther wrote this down, she went to these scribes, and they said, why should we write it this way? She says, don't ask me, boys, just write it that way. And for 2,000 years, 2,500 years, we've been writing it that way. What are the letters? Tav, Shin, and Zion. Tav, Shin, Zion. And one letter is written extra large. At the last line, you see the Vav? The Vav is written extra large. For 2,500 years, we've been writing that year into the text and not knowing why. Esther said, if it please the king, let the Jews do tomorrow as they have done today. Let the 10 sons of Haman, descendants of Amalek, be hung on the gallows. And in the year, which is written specifically in the text, they are hung. 10 of them, the transvestite, committed suicide. If you'll turn to the next page, the Nuremberg trials. You see here a quote from Newsweek, the column on the right. I'll skip to the end of it. It talks about the hanging of the 10 Nazis. Look at the last paragraph. Only Julius Streicher went without dignity. He had to be pushed across the floor, wild-eyed and screaming, Heil Hitler! Mounting the steps, he cried out, and now I go to God! He stared at the witness. Something facing the gallows, and shouted the very famous last words of Julius Streicher, Purim Fest, 1946. And nobody ever knows why he said that at the last minute of his life. I assure you, he did not take this company. We never had it at a seminar. That's what we mean by control. As what's going on here in history. The hour's late. I want to leave you with one story. We have seen, are we going to end now? We have seen five categories of evidence. We've seen mathematical evidence that there is material predicting the future encoded in the Torah that could not be there accidentally. That could not have been put there by a human being. We've seen information that could have not have been known by human beings at that time, which we can now verify. We've seen outside verification of the events of the Torah, showing it to be extremely accurate. We have a transmission process that makes it virtually impossible that error has occurred. We have control that shows us that the author does control history. That's a little overwhelming, isn't it? So I want to finish with one story. It's a very important story. It's a story that has only three characters, comes from the Bible, and it's one of the rare cases that I like to tell a story using the English versions of the names rather than the Hebrew, because of a reason that will become apparent. The characters are the prophet Elijah, the king Ahab, and his queen named Jezebel. And I like that name better than Ezebel, because in English it has such a nice ring to it, Jezebel. So we'll tell it with the English names. Idolatry is rampant in Israel. King Ahab is a shmendrik. He's not a good guy. And this queen Jezebel has come in with all of her idolatrous practices, and it's rampant throughout the whole country. And poor Elijah wants to do good. He's a type of person who can't tolerate imperfection. He doesn't understand imperfect people. That's the type of person Elijah was on such a high level. I put my watch on my wrist so I don't see any. So what happens? Elijah cries to God and says, "Oh Lord," he says, "I've been working with this people for years now. I'm not having a whole lot of success. Would you help me out? You know, I'm down here working alone. You're up there. I need a hand." God says, "What do you want?" "Give me one day, just one day in which I know everything will go okay. I can do anything and it'll be successful." God says, "You got it, Elijah. One day. You pick it. It's your day. Whatever you do is going to work." Elijah says, "Oh boy. Now I'm sick." He calls all the prophets of Baal, all the Jewish people together at Mount Carmel. It's before the hotel was there. And he says, "I want all the prophets of Baal," who is the principal deity that Jezebel is pushing on them here, "want you all to come. We're going to have a contest." Jewish people say, "Contest? Hey, that sounds pretty good. You know, Price is Right, you know, funny hats, the whole thing. We'll all get together around Mount Carmel. What's the contest going to be?" He says, "Here's what we're going to do. We will each prepare a sacrifice, a bullock. We'll lay it on, make an altar of stones, put wood on top, put the sacrifice on top. And you will call upon Baal, and I will call upon God. Neither one of us will light a fire. You call upon God to light a fire under yours. I'll call upon God to light a fire under mine, and we'll see who wins." I say, "Hey, sounds pretty good. Sounds like a fair contest, right?" Of course, what the Jews didn't know was that the prophets of Baal had hidden, and the Torah tells us this, had hidden a man in the rocks underneath their sacrifice, the little fire-making kit, to make it happen. Right? Good deal. He says, "Okay, boys, you go first." And the prophets of Baal start singing and dancing and doing all their things. What they didn't know was that God promised Elijah that on that day everything would go right. And a snake came and bit the young man hiding underneath and he died. They didn't know that. And they're singing and moving and hollering and no fire is coming. And they start cutting themselves and whipping themselves and doing all these things. And the oral Torah tells us that Elijah's having a good time. He's leaning back and saying, "Yell a little bit louder. Maybe he's hard to hear. Hey, you know, maybe he's in the bathroom. He's getting old." He was having a good time taunting them as they go on. Hours go by and nothing happens. And finally, the people are getting disillusioned, right? Elijah says, "Okay, boys, you've had your turn. My turn now." He says, "Hey, let's make this difficult. Takes water and pours it all over the wood. Right? Let's get it wet. All right?" And he says, "Oh, Lord." No. A fire comes down from heaven, burns up the sacrifice, burns up the wood, burns up the stones, even. Melts the stones. The people throw themselves on their faces. They say, "The Lord is God. The Lord is God. You convinced us. We see now. We see." They take the 400 prophets of Baal down to the river and they slaughter every one of them. This is what we call in the Bible a happy ending. But the story doesn't end there. It doesn't end there. What happens next is that Jezebel is furious. She's just furious about this. And she calls in the captain of the guard. and she says, I want you to go to Elijah, seek him out, and give him the following message. Tomorrow, at this time, you are a dead man. I'm going to kill you. Strange story. In the first place, why doesn't she tell the captain of the guard, go to Elijah and kill him? Right? Kill him tomorrow? Why not kill him today? Because Jezebel's a pretty smart cookie. She knows what happens if she goes and kills Elijah today. They just killed all the prophets of Baal. They're going to come after her. She has to wait until the effect of this sound and light show wears off. How long will that take? 24 hours. Elijah gets the message and he realizes it. He realizes, hey, I'm hot stuff today. Tomorrow, it's going to be business as usual. You can't change these people. A sound and light show doesn't last very long. He packs his bags and he heads for the hills, running for his life. Gets out there in the war and he says, oh Lord, I've had it with these people. After this, they still don't believe in you. After the sound and light show, they still don't believe in you. I can't take it anymore. Take me. Take me. I'm finished. Goes off in a moat into his cave. Then he hears a giant whirlwind coming outside. But he doesn't go out because he knows that God is not in the whirlwind. As an earthquake happens, he doesn't go out because he knows that God is not in the earthquake. And then he hears a still, small voice. And he arises. He goes out because he knows he's in God's presence. And God says to him, oh, my son Elijah, first of all, you're fired. Go and appoint Elisha as your follower. He'll take over. You messed up. You see, Elisha, he'll be able to deal with imperfect people. You, Elijah, got a problem. Got an attitude. Your problem is you expect people to be perfect, but they're not perfect. They're not perfect. Elijah doesn't die. Elijah's still with us. He still lives. Comes to every bris. Comes to every Seder. And sees the faithfulness of the Jewish people throughout generations. And in the end of days, he will be the one who tells us Mashiach is coming. Now that's Elijah's role. Why do I tell that story at this time? It's because a discovery seminar is a sound and light show. And you see evidence, and you see the codes, and you see this, and you go, wow, 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 wow. And how long does it last? 24 hours. Get back to work. Get back into things. People are that way. But the still small voice of reason shows us there is still hope. If out of a discovery seminar people say, not, wow, I'm convinced, but they say, hey, that's kind of interesting. I think I ought to check this out on myself to make sure that I put some note wrong. I think I should start to learn a little bit and see what's going on. Then we have a chance that out of a discovery seminar comes something which is meaningful. And I'll tell you frankly what the goal of the seminar is. The goal of the seminar, the reason that we do it, is to get people interested in learning and checking things out. I invite you all to use our resources here in Baltimore, and I thank you for coming to the seminar.
Dr. Goldfinger. I'm trying to take the quarter off.